and Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Amit Goswami, and we're going to talk about his most recent book, How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization. And for those of you that have not read this book, this is on my number one to read book. It's the book you should buy everybody you know for their birthday or for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever it is you celebrate. It's one that we have to get out to the world, everybody. It's a good one. So how are you, Dr. Goswami?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me, Eva.
Thank you for taking the time to come on. I appreciate it. Okay. Before we get started, take 1 minute and tell people where to find you. I mean, I'm sure everybody knows who you are and what you do, but just to make sure, where can they find your book?
Where can they find the book?
And your movie.
Our website, of course, amitgoswami.org, and Amazon, and of course the regular bookstore, Barnes & Noble, and so forth.
Okay. All right, we got a bunch of questions tonight. The first one is, who or what is God?
Well, finally we can answer such a question within science. Isn't that great? We have, according to quantum physics, if you want to solve quantum paradoxes, then the only way to solve it is to realize that consciousness is the ground of all being. God is the creative principle of consciousness.
Now, if you don't mind, many people define consciousness different ways, and that's a problem. What you mean by that word, please?
So that is why I'm spelling it all out, ground of all being. What that means is that all being, according to quantum physics, exists as possibilities first. And these possibilities are contained in the being that we call consciousness. You can call it Godhead. That's a Christian term that has the same kind of idea. This is not popular Christianity. This is esoteric Christianity, which very few people understand in the West. The Christianity that scientists mainly attack is popular Christianity. That has dualism. But in esoteric Christianity, it is very non-dual, and quantum physics is reviving those esoteric ideas which are common between Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, in Kabbalah, Sufism. Every religious tradition has an esoteric branch, very much obscure from popular consumption, where religions meet together and they have already figured out philosophically, not scientifically, but philosophically, that in order to be consistent logic, God cannot be defined in the popular way, in the dualist way, but God has to be defined as the creative agent of a Godhead, which is the ground of all being, including matter. In other words, matter is made of consciousness, Godhead, and not the other way around. Usually people think of consciousness as a brain phenomenon. Eradicate that thinking. That thinking is not consistent with quantum physics.
So to simplify all that, would the science mean that consciousness is energy?
Well, you can call it energy, but again, there is probably the word is misleading because energy is also used in terms of the motive power, something that has the motive power in physics, physical energy. And even if you are a connoisseur and you define energy as vital energy, even then, these energies are all contained in consciousness. They are not consciousness itself. So energy is this, consciousness is the source of everything,
okay,
including energy. It's subtler than energy, subtler than vital energy, subtler than mental meaning, subtler even than the supramental archetypes like love, beauty, justice. Those are very, very subtle concepts. But consciousness is subtler even than that. It's the ground of all subtle being, that exist in consciousness as possibilities. When consciousness looks, these possibilities become actual events that we experience.
So how does the material world and the non-dual God interact?
So that's the whole point. If God is non-dual, then it interacts with just by being it. If you are something, then you don't need to interact with the help of a signal. In dualism, what is conceived is God is separate from the world, so they have to interact with a signal, and we don't find such a signal. This existence of such a signal would have contradicted the law of conservation of energy. So scientists rightly criticize popular religions because of this dualism. But in the esoteric traditions, it was already recognized, and quantum physics is explicitly recognizing it, that if God is the, or Godhead is the ground of being, then everything is already consciousness. And then consciousness does not need any signal to interact. This is called quantum non-locality in the new science. Non-locality, signal-less communication. So how does consciousness exert interaction with matter? By choosing among the facets of possibility that matter represents. Consciousness chooses among those, and that becomes the conscious experience in a particular event.
Okay. The next question is, and I'm kind of going in chronological order in your book, is you state in your book that current terrorism has its root in the conflict between materials and religion. How does the new science of quantum mechanics integrate materiality and spirituality and allopathic and subtle alternative medicines?
Okay, this is a big question. So let's split it up. So how does quantum physics integrate materiality and spirituality? So this is the first one. We have already started on that one in answering your beginning questions. So if consciousness is the ground of being and matter is within it, this idea that consciousness is the ground of being already is within the spiritual tradition. Of course, the popular spiritual tradition got to stop this popular rendition. They got to give up this dualistic way of thinking. Now, there is a reason that they did that, that dualism prevailed. The reason is that the esoteric ideas are very difficult to understand because there was no way to visualize it. But now we have the concept of non-locality, and therefore we can visualize it better. The fact is that when two photons come out from a laser irradiated atom, these two photons, even though one goes this way, one goes the opposite direction, and even though they move far away from each other, even then, they continue to communicate. They continue to communicate, and experimentalists can measure that communication. So therefore, this way we can visualize that there are signal-less communications. So consciousness is the ground, and in which matter is the figure. That's the relationship between the two. How does consciousness interact? Consciousness chooses out of material possibilities the actual event. How does consciousness chooses? This downward causation is non-local. It's non-locally applied. And therefore, it's not a force. It's not a force that requires a signal to be applied. It's a choice. Happens non-locally, without signals. And this way, we can finally visualize what is actually going on when consciousness interacts with matter.
And allopathic and subtle medicine?
Allopathic and alternative medicine are integrated because now that we have conceived that everything is possibility, there is no reason to only restrict our possibilities to matter. We can easily see that there could be four kinds of possibilities because we have four kinds of experience. Not only do we have experience of sensing, we sense matter, but we have experience of feeling. What do we feel? We feel vital energies, not material energies, but vital energies. Of a vital world. So this concept can be reintroduced in science. This was banished because of dualism. It was thought that if vital energies existed, there would be a dual world. And how does that dual world interact with the physical? We don't have such a problem now. Non-locality solves everything. So consciousness mediates the interaction between vital energies and the physical. And so we feel the vital energy, then we think the mental, and we intuit the archetypal, the values. So in this way, we put in all four worlds of our experience into the equation, and that way we have a science which is complete, which is inclusive, which includes everything. Therefore, there is no dogma here. And we can also integrate allopathic and alternative medicine by realizing that allopathy talks about material medicine, only the material body and its disease. But in alternative medicine, the fact that there are other bodies, that we have a body in the vital world called the vital body, we have a body in the mental world called the mental body, we have a body in the supramental world called the supramental body, we are also part of total consciousness, call it the bliss body, we have then five bodies. And therefore, disease can be contracted if each of these five bodies become disconnected from the physical or incomplete in some ways. Energies are like vital energies are suppressed. And therefore, then the healing has to occur in these bodies first before it comes down to the physical. In other words, if the defect is occurring in the vital, you have to heal the vital body instead of treating the symptoms of the physical. That's what allopathy does. So in this way, these medicinal systems like Chinese medicine, Indian Ayurveda, homeopathy, mind-body medicine, these medicinal systems attack the problem at the source. And that's what their power is. That's why they are so effective, where allopathy in those cases is not very effective because it just treats the symptoms, so the disease comes back. So in this way, if we understand vital energy medicine, mental medicine, supramental medicine, then we can heal the whole body. We can heal the holistic problem of the body. So in this way, we integrate both allopathy and alternative medicine together in one integrative medicinal system.
If you don't mind, just for my listeners, would you please briefly define vital body?
Yes, of course. Vital body is the body connected with life. In biology, the concept of vital body has existed for a long time, until it was banished in the 1950s. The idea always was that there is something called vitality that is not material. And then when molecular biology was discovered in the 50s, materialist scientists felt that they have everything in their arsenal to explain everything that biology is. But that dream never became fulfilled. For example, origin of life still is a problem in biology. Biologists do not have a complete explanation of biological evolution. These things are kind of hush-hush, but they are well known among the experts. So in the 1980s, Rupert Sheldrake, a biologist, but a maverick one, he suggested that the problem of morphogenesis, biological form-making, cannot be solved staying within materialist biology. Because form-making, if you think about it, biological form, like brain, liver, a toe, how are they made starting with that one-celled embryo that we begin with? Because one cell becomes two cells, becomes four cells, and so on, it multiplies, and every cell is identical, but these organs perform such different functions. So this idea of form-making is a very difficult one, because how does a toe cell know that it's in the toe, and therefore one has to activate the corresponding genes to make the proteins that are necessary to carry out the toe function? Whereas in the liver, you have to correspondingly activate genes that will make proteins that will be able to perform the liver functions, and so on it goes in the brain. But how does the brain cell know? How does the toe cell know that it's in the toe? How does the brain cell know that it's in the head? So it's max of non-locality again, action at a distance. And therefore, Sheldrake proposed that there must be non-local morphogenetic fields, that's what he called these fields, that help form-making. Form-making cannot be done by genes alone. It is also the agency of morphogenetic fields is essential for biological making of organs. When you include this idea, you are already getting another world, a non-local world, a world that is connected within consciousness with the physical world. The organs are the representations of the morphogenetic field. They can be called the blueprint of the organs. So in this way, we are introducing a concept, morphogenetic fields, which is just another name, you know, of vital body, because now we are giving some form to the vital body. In the previous thinking, it was just a philosophical idea that it's necessary to provide us vitality. Now we realize that it is really provide us blueprints for biological forms, and therefore the movement of morphogenetic field is what we feel as vital energy. So when you are in romance and you are feeling vital energy in your heart chakra is going kind of, throbbing or at least feeling warm, what is happening is this movement is movement of the morphogenetic fields that are connected with the thymus gland, which decides whether your immune system will accept this person or not accept this person as you. The immune system decides me or not me. That's the job of the thymus gland. So in this way, we connect the action of the thymus gland with the corresponding morphogenetic field, and the energy of movement of the morphogenetic field is what we feel as romantic energy. Okay, I accept you. You are mine. You are my body. And therefore, my body will not reject you. You see the connection? So yeah. It's a very beautiful explanation now of the entire paraphernalia of vital energies and vital bodies, which have been well known since, you know, hundreds of years. Much before physical energy was a concept in physics, William Blake is already talking about in a poem in the 18th century, energy is eternal delight. Now, where do we find the word energy? Obviously, energy did not mean physical energy. Physical energy was introduced in physics in 1837, 19th century. So Blake was talking about vital energy, which Indians call prana, and in China it's called qi. So it has been known really for millennia.
Okay. Now, some of my questions is going to be redundant, but as we go through, but I ask them because I know that's what, you know, this is a hard thing for some people to grasp, and I want people to have their questions in the way they can understand it. So be patient with me, okay?
Of course.
This is. Okay, the next one, and you've already said it, but if you have anything to add, how do we know that the new science is scientific?
Okay, science has two prongs. One is theory. The theory, the requirement is that theory has to be consistent. The logic has to be consistent. And the other requirement of theory is that a good theory will have a verifiable prediction. If the predictions cannot be verified, some people say falsification, there has to be a prediction, falsification of which falsifies the theory. So in both ways, falsification or verification, you have predictions that can be tested experimentally. This is the crucial second prong of a good science. These days, of course, this is mainstream science. This is the definition from mainstream. But unfortunately, mainstream people are now violating this rule right and left. For example, I'll give you a pseudoscientific notion. Stephen Hawking suggested many years ago that there are little specks of black holes, mini black holes, he called it. But there is no way of experimentally verifying it. So this is an example of a bad science because you cannot verify it. It only accidentally, if some mini black hole turns up to be on Earth, then only we can look at it. But that's really very far out idea and never going to happen. So, and if it happens, then we would not have known it because it would have fallen into the black hole and be destroyed. So it's kind of a funny notion, but these papers, these scientific ideas became very popular and make huge ruckus. There are many such ideas in modern science that is not verifiable. You have to be very careful. Many worlds theory, and so-called explanation of quantum measurement problem. That's another example, even worse than mini black hole. This one cannot be verified at all, but it stands. the present theory, that theory that I'm talking about, the beauty of it is that the non-locality, quantum non-locality, is a verifiable idea. The whole theory is based on the idea of quantum non-locality, because if consciousness is the ground of being and it exerts choice for from possibility to actuality, then it has to be without signal. The signal-less interaction got to exist, not only at the microscopic level between photons, but also between brains. Jacobo Greenberg, a neurophysiologist at the University of Mexico, he verified that human beings can communicate without signals. How did he do it? Well, two people meditate together, and then with the intention that they will have non-local direct communication without signals, and then they are put in Faraday chambers. That means that they are electromagnetically impervious rooms. And then they're sitting there, their brains are connected with electroencephalogram machines that measure brain waves, and now only one subject is shown, a series of light flashes. That produces electrical activity in that brain, which is measured by the EEG machine connected to that brain, from which a signal is extracted by eliminating the noise. All that is fine, completely kosher. But now, when they measure the brain waves collected from the EEG of the other subject who has not seen any light flashes, they find, lo and behold, there is also a electrical activity in that brain as measured by the brain waves. It gives a signal, they call it transfer potential, which is practically identical with the evoked potential in both phase and strength. So the explanation of it has to be that there is a non-local connection, because local connection has already been eliminated by putting them in Faraday cages. So you have direct proof of non-local connections. There are similarly many, many proofs now. This is what I wrote a book called God Is Not Dead, but most of those experiments have been also mentioned in the book that you are reviewing, How Quantum Activism Can Save Civilization. People should become familiar with these experiments. Once they are, they will have no doubt that this new science is completely valid science. It's not like many world theory, which is just an idea that we cannot verify, not at all. It has consequences, it has technology. Alternative medicine can be thought upon as a vital energy technology. So we have an idea, we have a science which is giving us both scientific verification in the laboratory and also technology on the basis of those ideas. Therefore, this science is now in full force. It just is a matter of people becoming familiar with it, look at its consistency, and shift from the other worldview to this worldview. It's only a matter of time. There is no question that this is the more appropriate, this is the dogma-free, inclusive worldview that will replace both of the old worldviews. There are two worldviews now. One is the Republican worldview, as you know, the dualism, Republican Christian religious worldview, and the other one is the scientific materialistic worldview. Both of these worldviews will have to give way to this integrative way of looking at things, because this is, this is what science is about. There is a consistent theory, no logical paradox, and there are experimental data supporting it, and then technology on the basis of what we have theorized.
You know, Neil deGrasse Tyson has a statement that I have on my screen every day. The good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe it.
Yes, because of technology. Like, the Christians have everything against all kinds of scientific ideas, whether the world has existed for Earth has existed for 5 billion years or Earth has existed for 6,000 years. This kind of thing they debate. But when it comes to electricity, they can use electricity. So science exists either way. That is a very, very good statement. So if you take vital energy medicine like homeopathy, it will work on you whether you believe it or not.
My next question is, if consciousness is primary, and this is a quote out of your book, then meanings and values are real and must be the focus of our lives. Why do you say that?
Well, meanings and values are things that matter cannot process. So in the scientific materialist worldview, meanings and values are concoctions of the brain. they don't have any causal efficacy. Our search for meaning is what our life, human life, is usually all about. People are very worked up about this. According to scientific materialism, all this search that we do for meaning in our life is actually fruitless because they don't have any causal effect on the world. The world goes on independent of how we put meaning on something and don't put meaning on other thing, or how we value something and don't put value on other things. According to scientific materialism, this is just a superposition on what really is going on. This is not what is really going on. This is kind of a schizophrenic world that we live because, we value what we value, but there are really mad people's value. Schizophrenia is a very, very good notion. According to scientific materialism, we are all sort of schizophrenics. We have our own internal world, and we make up things that seems to have validity for us, but actually there is no validity. That's the worldview they have constructed. Scientific materialist, they don't think about it this way, but that's what it essentially means. If meanings and values really were meaningless and valueless.
And the next question is, the new science tells that conscious collapse with real freedom of choice is one, discontinuous, a quantum leap in the cell of an electron jumping from one atomic orbit to another without going through the intervening space. Two, non-local, involving not the individual but the collective or cosmic consciousness. And three, tangled hierarchical. This is the science of free will. Can you please simplify this for my listeners?
Yes, this one needs some elaborate explanation. Because of the last one that you mentioned, non-locality, I think people are already clear on that. That's the signalless communication. So free will, freedom comes to us only when we are in that non-local consciousness. This should be very clear. We have very limited freedom. We have some. We never lose freedom completely. So even when we are conditioned, even when we are not in this non-local consciousness, even then we have some freedom. We have at least freedom to say no to conditioning. You must have noticed that you can give up addiction, for example. Addiction to cigarette, many people have given up. People can lose their weight, not have to eat compulsively. So how do they do that? In behaviorism, it would be very difficult to explain except as reconditioning. But in the new science, we can say no to conditioning. We have that power. So some freedom remains, even in the ego. But real freedom, freedom to choose the new, something that never has happened before, something an idea that never has been manifested before, to be able to choose that possibility for meaning and value, which we call creativity, that is only possible in the new scientific way of looking at things, non-locality. When you are in non-local consciousness, you can do it. But this choice also is discontinuous. It's like a quantum leap. When electrons go from one atomic orbit to another, it does not go through the intervening space. Similarly, when we think a new idea, we don't think the new idea continuously from old ideas, as a consequence of old ideas following deductive reasoning. We don't do that. We don't even do that by inductive reasoning. That too is continuous. We do it instead by a quantum leap. All of a sudden, we just have the idea. So how did we get it? We got it because we jumped from the mental domain to the supramental domain suddenly, all of a sudden, without going through the intervening space, because they are not connected. It's outside of the space-time reality. So in that way, discontinuity is another feature of freedom, real freedom. Real freedom is expressed in creativity. And then third of all is tangled hierarchical. This is a little bit more complex, but quantum physics, when properly analyzed, turns out that the brain is a very, very different apparatus than anything else, or not anything else. Living cell has the same characteristic. All living bodies, let's put it that way, have a very different structure than non-living bodies. Non-living bodies remain possibilities. They can never become actualities by themselves. How do they become actualities in us? Because we have this very special apparatus. that is not like ordinary non-living objects. We have a fundamental difference between a living cell and a piece of rock. And that fundamental difference of composition is that a piece of rock is made continuously out of electrons and protons and neutrons, making up atoms, making up molecules, making up cell, making up the body of the rock. But when the molecules make up cells, it doesn't do it that way. It does it in a discontinuous, tangled, hierarchical way. So this hierarchy, atoms making molecules, this is called simple hierarchy because you can tell the difference. Atoms determine the structure of molecules, but not the other way around. Elementary particles ultimately determines everything because that's the bottom, the causal level of this simple hierarchy. But the tangled hierarchy's concept is totally different. It's a circular causality. I affect you, but you affect me too, and infinitely going on and on. I should give an example for the listener to get the idea clearly, because it's a really absolutely amazing idea. Circular cause, circularity. Think of a sentence called, I am a liar. This is called liar sentence. Are you saying it already? If I'm a liar, then I'm telling the truth. If I'm telling the truth, then I am lying. And then I'm telling the truth, then I'm lying. So it goes on and on and on and on. Once you are in it, you cannot get out of it unless, of course, you get out of the whole thing consciously by lifting yourself from that circular logic. So we can get out of it because we don't entirely have to identify with it. But once we do it and do it seriously, then we are caught. So this idea is called self-reference. Consciousness, when it measures a system, when it chooses with the help of the brain, or with the help of a living cell, then it identifies with it because it gets caught in this tangled hierarchical mold. So these systems, like the brain, like the living cell, they got to have this tangled hierarchy within them. This is the difference between a rock and a living cell, or rock and a brain. Brain has a tangled hierarchy within it. Living cell has a tangled hierarchy within it, so consciousness can identify with them. And in the process of doing that, it manifests the world, whereas a rock remains a possibility forever. It cannot of itself see itself. It does not have self-reference. It does not have the capacity of seeing itself separate from the world. Okay? This is a little bit puzzling concept. So, listener, please beware. If you need to read something extra, just read any of my books. It is explained from the very first book, which is called Self-Aware Universe, and the whole gamut of books that I have written, I always have explained this very, very carefully. And if my explanation here seemed too quick to go by, the reading has the advantage, book has the advantage that you can repeat and read again. If I repeat here, it will be too boring, so I won't do that. But I completely sympathize with you that probably hearing it one time still leaves you with a little bit uncertain feeling. I sympathize.
This next question is not one that I planned, but I'm going to bring it up because it has to do with this. Let's say that someone is living a life that's very dramatic and chaotic, and they want to change that life, and assuming that we do not have complete free will, this is going to be a two-part question. Can we get out of that life with consciousness? And if so, how do we do it? Do we have to be in an altered state to facilitate that more quickly? Does that make sense? A more cohesive state?
Yeah, it makes sense. What's your third part?
That's all. I mean, how do we change a chaotic life?
Okay, good question. So, first of all, is it possible to change it? Yes, it's completely possible to change it. We have the capacity. We have to be creative about it. So all these things that we just discussed is very, very useful. Because how do we be creative? We use any of these vehicles. There are paths to creativity, paths to this free will. How do we become free? Well, one vehicle is non-locality. We cultivate non-locality. How do we become free? We cultivate creativity. We cultivate discontinuity. How do we become free? We cultivate tangled hierarchy. People who love, they know about tangled hierarchy a little bit. When we are in romance, to some extent, we have a self that completely absorbs the other. The other is included. So tangled hierarchy is like that, but not entirely like it. Because in romantic love, although there is an enormous attraction, there is also some narcissism continued. Although I can do anything for the other, but still because the other is mine, that sense continues. When we recognize the otherness of the other and still do anything for the other, you know, when we are in romance, we often say, I'll die for you. I mean, and James Bond, you know, very romantic character, as you know, actually makes huge efforts of saving the life of this partner, and then he indeed would die for her. It seems that way in the movies, at least. But that is the way it feels in when we are in romance, right? So tangled hierarchy is like that, except that there is no narcissism. You completely recognize that the other is the other, and yet you can die for this person. So it's a very wonderful relationship where there's a self of the self-preference. You have the self of the partnership. You are so entangled with the person that you do not think that the person is separate only. The person is also you. But it is you and separate. This is the paradox of spirituality. It's both separate and together. In spirituality, we are both ego and non-local consciousness. So tangled hierarchy is really a wonderful, most wonderful way of relating to people. That is when unconditional love happens between people. So those are the three paths. We can go the non-local way, and we just cultivate non-local relationships, non-local communication. That's the way of the psychic. That's the way of the mystic. And creativity is another way, where, again, we take quantum leaps of creativity to reach this. You can call it an altered state. I call it by the name of quantum self, but this higher self, this very non-local self. That's a joyful state in which we get into when we have a creative insight. And then, of course, this tangled hierarchy where we just love somebody, but so deeply, with such high respect, and yet with such wonderful feelings of oneness with this person, that the relationship becomes loving, truly. So those are the three paths of approaching freedom.
Okay, let me see if I can ask this question appropriately. If people are, say, in a relationship where there is a lot of drama, and the people love each other, if you are trying to evolve on your spiritual path, do you run from that relationship if you're the seeker, if you're truly a spiritual seeker? Do you run from it and go to the next one? And this was not a planned question, so I'm doing the best I can. Or do you stay there and say, there are lessons here for me to learn, and I'm going to stay here and learn these lessons and evolve, and life will smooth out if we do our job? Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. But, you know, in spirituality, at least in the quantum way of looking at things, we never judge the person for doing one thing or the other. In other words, we don't make any set rules. Sometimes the relationship, to get a committed relationship out of a situation is very difficult. You just cannot seem to have the power to commit yourself to something. Does that mean that you cannot move away from the relationship because of the lack of commitment? No, the whole idea of working in a relationship the whole idea is commitment. And that commitment depends on the particular situation. So if somebody just cannot be committed to a particular person, do I judge that person? No. It's just that between these two people, commitment has lost value. somehow they are just, there is not that modicum of trust that has to be for being committed to something. And without that commitment, you cannot really work towards creativity. Creativity requires a burning question. It will burn out your old ego. And so without that commitment to the problem that you're handling, problem in this case, of course, is finding love, it is very difficult. So you can walk away, and quantum physics will be quite neutral about you. It will not judge you. It's not a moral science. Morality is not, quantum morality is not the same as people usually interpret it. They make moral rules. Quantum morality is always creative. You ask the question, can I be creative within this relationship? And if your answer is that yes, you can commit and you can be creative in this relationship, there is enough here for me to be creative, then stay. But on the other hand, if the answer comes back, no, I cannot be creative, I cannot grow in this relationship, then however much you have a feeling of dependency, however much you have a feeling of, you know, so-called love, I say so-called love because this is not unconditional love, it's conditional. You like some aspects, but you want the person to change in some other ways, then of course you cannot commit. And then if you move away, quantum physics will have no judgment about you. It's okay. It's not that we are saying okay that way, but we're not approving. But we're neither disapproving nor approving. We're neutral about it. Quantum physics is completely objective that way.
Okay. But if the individual is really trying to grow and choose to stay, then and grow from whatever the things are, then that's a brownie point, that they grow.
Well, the new word is, of course, in the growth. So, yes, if we remain committed in the relationship, the new words are enormous because we do grow. But remember that commitment is best served when it is mutual. If sometimes what happens is that one person has too much of force of intention, and one person carries the other in terms of strength of intention, and the other's commitment may not be very strong to be creative. So what happens then is that the one person will make the creative leap, and that is still rewarding, very rewarding. But the other person may not be able to go at the same pace. And therefore, yes, the relationship will lack at some point. But at that point, what happens is that you don't make any difference anymore because you have already grown. And because you have already grown, you know also that it doesn't really matter whether to stay in the relationship or not. And therefore, your principle becomes different. Your principle is not to hurt somebody. And therefore, out of just pure compassion, you can stay in the relationship, knowing fully well that the other person has not quite arrived where you have arrived. You can love this person unconditionally, but the other person is not there yet. But you can still stay within the relationship. Why? Because you have woken up to the fact that you can be compassionate in the world. And really, there is nothing to lose by being compassionate. There is nothing to lose.
Great response. So you keep using this word creativity. Please define that and elaborate on its four-stage process.
Okay, so creativity, as I have already said, is the discovery or invention of something new of value, the new meaning of value. This value is very important. You have to have, you know, like love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness. These are our main values. Plato called them archetypes. They are archetypes of mental thinking, and indeed, they are the most important values that we covet in our life. So, in creativity, the highest creativity always is about these things, these values. Like the scientist, for example, looks for the value called truth. One wants to find the laws of the universe, the truth about the universe. What is the universe like? What are the laws of reality? Artist, on the other hand, looks at more of beauty and love, that kind of thing. The moralist, the ethicist, they look at goodness, the archetype of goodness. Can I be good to my neighbor? How to do that? How to live happily with fellow human beings? Ethics. So on and on it goes. justice, that's another one, another very important one right now for America and elsewhere, because we have gross injustices showing up in our society. For a while, we are doing okay in the Justice Department. Recently, we are going backwards to feudal kind of situation where the rich get richer, too much rich, and poor gets too much poor, and helplessness returns, the mobility between the levels disappear. This is unjust, unfair. So, you know, as you know, this most recent political turn is that one political candidate is criticizing fairness. Their focus is economy at all costs, but no, fairness is not a good thing for, you know, election campaign. That's absolutely wrong from the quantum point of view. Fairness is very, very relevant for every point of view, because that is a value that we hold very highly. It's justice. So in this way, this is what creativity is about. How do you become creative? It turns out that it is not just doing a lot of stuff. You know, sometimes many people think, like scientific materialists mostly think, that it's all a question of having some talent, and then it's a question of how hard you are prepared to work. You work very hard, and then you have this special characteristic. Maybe you have the capacity of divergent thinking, and you have the capacity of convergent thinking after you have done your divergent thinking, and that's the way they look at things. Quantum physics is a very different thing, and data that creativity theorists have collected that agrees with quantum physics. Quantum physics says that no, you first read, of course, you read, you study, you listen to people, you get acclimatized to the problem, you get acclimatized to what you're intuiting about the problem and all that. So problem forms in a very specific way, and then you become open about the possibilities that should come to solve your problem. You realize that no known knowledge will ever solve this problem. You have to move outside of the context of the problem. You have to move, like take a quantum leap. We have to be ready for that. And for that, what I need is to wait, learn to wait. So second stage, according to quantum physics and according to the field researchers, is called incubation, like a bird sits on its egg without doing anything. So the creative person also similarly just relaxes, does nothing. And then the third stage is insight. That's when the insight comes. And then depending on what the insight is, you manifest the insight into a product. That's the manifestation. So preparation, first stage, read, get acclimatized, become open to possibilities. Second stage, incubation, just wait. Don't do anything. Third stage, insight. Fourth stage is manifestation. I have added a little bit of subtlety to this. It came to me as a creative insight that the preparation and incubation you have to do is sort of alternatively. Do-be-do-be-do, I call it, you know, to make a pun. You remember the Frank Sinatra jingle. Do be, do be, do. Because it's alternate doing and being. That's what works the best for creativity. It's not doing a lot and then sitting down a lot. No, it doesn't work that way. You have to keep the intensity of doing. Because without that intensity, the unconscious doesn't get churned up. Being just means unconscious processing. What happens is that when we are relaxing, quantum possibilities proliferate, because there are waves of possibility. So they proliferate, becoming bigger and bigger waves, and so we get to choose from bigger and bigger pools of possibility. That's what actually takes place. That is why we need to wait. So doing, working, then relaxing, being. So doing, being goes on for a while. Suddenly this quantum leap takes place, and we get the insight. And then we again sit down and manifest. But this, there are more subtleties here. I'm just finishing a book on creativity called Quantum Creativity. Think quantum, be creative. So in that book, I explain all these things much more accurately. But if you read the How Quantum Activism Concepts Civilization, it has also chapters on creativity. And some basic ideas are already there.
Okay, what is social consciousness and why is it so important to both individuals and the business world?
Well, consciousness way of looking at the world, there are several things for the business world. Right now, businesses are kind of stuck because creativity is...
Hello?
Hello, yes. Creativity is undermined because creativity doesn't exist in the materialist way of looking at things. So we are not very creative anymore in the world, and this is affecting businesses very much because businesses need to be creative. Innovation has gone down. You must have heard this a lot. I mean, you know, media is full of outcry. Why are we not having innovations, etc.? We are having some. Some innovation obviously continue, but we did not have any major innovation for quite some time. Why it is that we are coming sort of an end of the cycle of this kind of economy that we run, which is continuous expanding economy, but we don't know where to expand because the material world is a finite world. What we have to do is to take the idea of consciousness and recognize that consciousness has within it not just the material world, but also the vital, the mental, even the supramental. So why don't you use the products of vital, mental, supramental as equations for business? Why don't people produce mental, vital, supramental goods as well as material goods for us to consume? We extend our economy to the subtle. I am actually working on this theory very, very actively. Very, very actively. And the theory is that include the subtle, and it will do better.
What is evil, Amit?
Evil is when we go against evolution. When you go against evolution, it's evil. When we go in favor of evolution, but I'm not talking about Darwinian evolution. I'm talking about evolution in the sense of consciousness. Conscious evolution is purposive, and the purpose of evolution is to manifest the values that we so much covet, that we study creatively. When that manifestation falls behind, we are becoming separate from the whole. Evil is separateness from the whole. That is what really evil is. So all of us, when we are not actively engaging with these values, then we take the risk of being separate. And indeed, people feel depressed when they are not satisfied with their lives, when their soul is not satisfied. Soul satisfaction comes from this engaging with these archetypes. If we don't engage with love, if we don't engage with justice, if we don't engage with goodness, beauty, or truth, then we feel dissatisfied. You know, depression is now one of the, this is the third leading cause of disease, depression. It's the third major disease today, behind heart disease and cancer. And why do people feel depressed? Because they're not satisfied with their life. This is the thing that is taking place. Okay?
Mm. What determines our place in the creativity spectrum?
Well, that has to do with reincarnation. We incarnate many times. We incarnate many times in our life. It is a series of lives that go on. This life, we die, then we are born again, and we die again, and so on and so forth. And as we go on living these incarnations, we become more and more mature, and the place in the creativity spectrum is determined by that maturity. After a while, if you have seen, there was a beautiful movie made. I really recommend this movie called Groundhog Day. Bill Murray acted in it. And he was looking for love. And it's sort of very, very well done in the movie context. And that is precisely what happens. People come back again and again and again looking for these archetypes. they become mature because they become more interested in more and more abstract things. Initially, we are interested only in material goodies. You can see that in the world today. Some people just cannot move beyond their material pleasures and stuff. They're not going to be very creative. They are what is called more into the brain circuits, pleasure circuits. And then you graduate from that one, then you seek power. So then you have creativity, but you're using it for power, which separates you from people. So you're still not creative in the highest sense because you are still moving yourself not so much towards God, but away, a little bit away from God by seeking power. That power separates you from other people. And then finally, you recognize the limits of power. You work towards giving up power. You work towards wholeness. And that is when highest of creativity is realized. So all people that are really, really creative, wonderfully creative, you find them to be also spiritual, like Mahatma Gandhi, Einstein. These people, not only they were greatly creative, but they were also had a spiritual streak in them. That spiritual streak, it comes because you recognize that you are also whole with the world. So you not only want to serve your own individual, amassing power and fame and all that, but you also want to serve others. You want to serve humanity itself. And these people, as you know, they did so much for humanity, Einstein, Gandhi, and people of that ilk.
So, I don't want you to spend a lot of time on this, but many people will object to the notion that there is such thing as a reincarnation. Is there science to support that?
Well, there is a lot of data supporting it. There's just so much data. I mean, after a near-death experience, which has been now codified by really many, 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 many people's experience and really systematic study of those experiences, people literally die. According to materialist science, these people are dead. They are declared brain dead. Their brain waves are flat. EEG machine gone flat. So they're dead. And still they report things like otoscopic vision. The person will say that I was hovering over the operating room on my body and I saw this thing my surgeons did. And they're so specific, not general description, but specific to that particular event of surgery. They will report all that. So how can one report something when one is already dead? So obviously something survived. So
yeah.
Survival after death, once you prove that, then from that proving reincarnation is not such a big thing because reincarnation, of course, is tremendously favored by the fact that many people remember the reincarnational memory and they've been telling us about reincarnational memory that can be verified and has been verified by many very trustworthy and qualified researchers. So there is very little doubt about those things. And then finally, there is the phenomenon of channeling, for which now objective data exists, which suggests reincarnation also. And then the phenomenon of what reincarnates, we have a very good theory that memory is non-local, and for which there is direct data that memory is indeed non-local. So again, I'm talking about a theory of how reincarnation can take place, and then a direct verification of the idea of the theory, which makes it into a credible science.
Yeah, I heard Brian Weiss speak this weekend about his work with hypnotherapy, too. That was pretty convincing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, my next one is, why does pleasure always end up in pain and separateness?
Say it again.
Why does pleasure always end up in pain or separateness?
Those things are brain circuits. No, so pleasure, we have a brain circuit. For pain, some of it is probably just physical brain circuits caused, but pain also is a separation of the vital and the physical. So this separateness, we are not experiencing the wholeness. Pleasure, when we are experiencing a brain circuit, that kind of pleasure is not wholeness. It's a remembered pleasure. It's a pleasure because you are activating a brain circuit. It's keeping me separate in the pleasure. If pleasureful people are usually very egocentric, they are very narcissistic. And so they're separate. And that's why when the pleasure goes away, they seek either more pleasure or they feel unhappy, they feel dissatisfied because they are not getting the real joy, which is wholeness.
Okay. I have a perspective here that I'd like to ask you. It's a mystical perspective that I channeled, actually, that, you know, if energy doesn't stop, it just changes form. Then if you, people that live, who are very passionate, you know, live very passionate lives, you know, always running in the fast lane, it's like swinging in a swing in a big oak tree. You know, the swing goes up real high in the front, but it's also guaranteed to go the same degree backwards. So it kind of makes me think of, to whatever degree you live that pleasure, you're going to live that same degree of pain at some point unless you learn how to walk down the middle of the road. Does that make any sense to you?
It makes some sense, but it's not a balancing trick either. I mean, it is true that that pleasure ends up in pain, but, you know, a modicum of pleasure, this is the middle of the road that you are saying, modicum of pleasure is good strategy for a while. Modicum of pleasure, and then we get we keep the circuit satisfied, so to speak. I follow that strategy myself, so it's not to be decried. But a stage comes when you don't need that anymore. I haven't arrived that stage myself, but you know, I believe what the spiritual traditions say, that stage comes when you just lose all interest in pleasureful activity. And then you don't need to have this modicum of pleasure, modicum, you know, you don't need to follow the middle path anymore. You can just renunciate. And that's when people realize, like Buddha's first noble truth, life is suffering. Then you want to be free, totally free.
Walking in the middle of the road is just being in the moment.
Staying in the moment is a good policy for walking in the middle as well. That's another way of putting it. But, you know, those are just words to convey an idea because the human condition is not for us to be able to stay in the middle. We cannot. We literally are not able to because the mechanism cannot do it continuously. We can stay in the moment when we are in that creative insight, that kind of altered state, but we cannot stay in the moment ongoing in a continuous basis. We just cannot. The nature of the brain will not permit it. So that being the case, we have to be very careful. So for most of us, the middle path is a very good strategy. But at some point, you know, you go beyond the middle path. That's when you are enlightened. That's when, you know, when Buddhahood has arrived, then no longer is middle path necessary.
Yes. Okay. What do you mean by unrealistic spiritual aspirations?
Unrealistic spiritual aspirations are those that are untimely. There is a very, very, very difficult thing, difficult message, very difficult message because it's very confusing in this whole idea of how to become enlightened. Enlightenment eventually, this liberation, freedom, total freedom, eventually requires giving up the ego completely. However, when we are not ready for it, when we are still seeking accomplishment, when we are still seeking pleasure, the subject that we just touched, in those times we are not ready for that final thrust of creativity where we want to know the real self, the real enchilada, the wholeness. We really have to be ready to renunciate everything, completely recognize that life is suffering. Which means that when a complete indifference to pleasure, when complete indifference to accomplishments arrive, only then one should really aspire to be enlightened. Otherwise, what happens is that people get experiences, but they look at those experiences as accomplishment. And that's why we find so many gurus today who are very much into sexuality, very much into pleasure, very much into making big empires. And then we wonder, what kind of freedom is this when the guru is enjoying having pain, having suffering, having loss of temper? What is going on? We get confused. But that is what we mean by untimely exploration of spirituality, spiritual enlightenment. One should be ready when that indifference comes, then only.
That's what I mean when I say the middle of the road is indifference.
But middle of the road also means between, you know, you have a modicum of pleasure and modicum of pain, you just accept it. That also middle of the road. So I was interpreting it that way. Okay, you are entitled to having that kind of middle of the road also. I mean, that's really not middle of the road. It's really an extreme position. I'm indifferent to everything, right? You know what I mean? You are really indifferent to all accomplishments, all worldly things. Like, you know, in Indian philosophy, there is Shankara, who says the world is illusion. The material world itself, you renunciate everything because it means nothing. It's that kind of message. Yeah, when you truly feel that nothing is worthwhile anything, been there, done that, then you are ready.
Linguistics is always a problem, you know, in trying to describe this stuff. My next one is, what is the role, and this, I don't know if this is going to make sense, what is the role of thinking in physical reality relative to spiritual balance, mood disorders, etc.? Does that make sense?
I did not quite understand it, so I suppose it did not yet make sense.
Oh.
Please repeat.
Say it this way. I always tell people, stop thinking. The goal of the soul is to observe and not react. Stop thinking.
So stop thinking.
You create, and people aren't always ready for what they create. So
okay.
They get spiritual imbalance and depression and things like that because they're thinking too much.
Yeah.
Mind's running away.
There is something called thinking too much. There is something called thinking too much. If when we become too detached from our feelings, that is a very dangerous state. When we think too much, meaning that we are excluding feelings and excluding intuition, then we lose touch with reality. Our reality consists of sensing the physical, feeling the vital, thinking the mental, and intuiting the supramental. If we ignore any of these worlds, we become imbalanced. And this lack of balance is not a good thing. It separates. What happens immediately, we are not achieving wholeness. Wholeness is when we take care of all the bodies well. So wholeness means engaging with each of these experiences in a regular way. Of course, we are not going to be so much intuitive if we are not ready for it, but a little bit of that we must. We must have some blissful moment in our life. If we miss wholeness too much, we become overall a sense of ennui, that depression develops. We're not satisfied. So we got to have these blissful moments in our life. We got to have some sort of search of supramental truths, values. We got to have some meaning in our life, and we got to satisfy our senses. I'm not against pleasure and pain at all. I think we got to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that, until we become ready to renunciate. But that comes after many, many lives, and ordinary people like me should not worry about it, is my judgment.
What is emotional intelligence?
Well, emotional intelligence is the idea that we can travel the middle road, we can travel between pleasure and pain without getting too upset about negative emotions. When we are only living the life of pleasure and pain, we are too much into negative emotions because pain certainly will overwhelm us. For a little bit of pleasure, how much pain we suffer often, we know. We have to recognize that. And so when we recognize that, then we can go towards relationship. Then we can go towards emotional intelligence, which is to balance the negative by positive. Not balance the negative by pleasure. We try to balance the negative by pleasure. Instead, when you try to balance the negative by developing positive emotions, which is that love, those are the positive emotions, love, expression, wholeness, knowledge, those are positive emotions. So when we have positive emotional brain circuit, then the negative will be truly balanced. When you try to balance pleasure and pain, that is balancing between two sets of conditioned behavior.
Okay.
When we balance negative emotion through positive emotions, we are achieving a much better balance. This is what actually Buddha meant by middle path, not quite the way we are talking about earlier. That's for the very beginners. That's the middle path. But as you become advanced, you realize that you have the capacity to make positive emotional brain circuit. You make some of them. Then you become truly middle path. That's when you have become emotionally intelligent.
If one has anger, what are they to do with it?
Okay, so you have anger. So, you know, usually we express it. That messes up my relationship with the world. If we suppress it, that messes up my own unconscious. Both are equally bad. So what to do? Well, we try to meditate on it. But if you try to meditate on it, not express, not suppress, you will find that it is very difficult. So that's when you realize that you really have to have a positive emotional brain circuit to live outside of the tyranny of this anger. So truly, the way to deal with anger eventually is to make the brain circuit of love. When you have that, when you have loved somebody, you make a brain circuit of it by loving, and then you find that when anger arises, the love circuit also will arise and enable you to become emotionally intelligent. You don't have to strike out against a person or against yourself by suppressing it. You can just bring your love circuit into the foreground, and immediately emotional intelligence will automatically come to you, and you will be able to take the appropriate action.
I only have two more questions. Do you think mystics are irrational, out of touch with reality, or psychotic or schizophrenic?
No. I think mystics are non-rational. Mystics are very creative people. But of course, there are mystics because of they are on the path. When in the path to mysticism, like Freud realized a long time ago, that many creatives have a neurotic streak in them. So on the path to mysticism, some people go borderline neurotic, not schizophrenic, never. Schizophrenia is opposite of mysticism. But neurotic, yes, because creativity and neurosis, at some level, especially if you have not worked on this unconscious stuff, this repressed stuff, and some people haven't. You know, many people go into spirituality untimely. They're not ready for that yet. So for them, neurosis might very well play a role in their creativity, and in which case we do see neurotic behavior in so-called spiritual aspirants. So that's not completely wrong.
What is neurosis, just so everybody knows?
Say it again.
What is neurosis, just so everybody knows?
What is my what?
Neurosis.
Noesis.
Neurotic. What is that? Just so people understand.
Gnosis is this enlightenment that we are talking about. Now, some people call it gnosis. It's the knowing the reality, knowing the truth, ultimate truth.
That's it, neurotic.
Yeah, noetic is the same thing, same word, a little bit. That's the adjective.
I thought you said mystics can become neurotic.
Neurotic, no, neurotic. That's what I mean. I mean, that's not noetic. Sorry, there are two different words. Yes, mystics can have a neurotic streak because of the because of their lack of work on the subconscious.
So if some people don't know what that word means. If you could just say what you mean by that.
Neurotic. Maybe I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Neurotic, neurosis. You know, like having some neurotic behavior, people washing their hands unnecessarily, that kind of thing.
Okay, like OCD and anxiety and things
anxiety,
like that.
Anxiety, neurosis. Anxiety is a good example of neurosis, yes. Anxiety, neurosis, yes.
Okay. And my last one is I'd like for you to talk about your letter to the president, and I'm curious, have you heard anything that
No, I didn't expect anything. You know, they get millions of letters, and so, no.
Did you send them your book?
No. The book was never sent, no.
I think you should do that.
All right. I'll do it. I'll do it.
I mean, if you can't get it to him, I can. I have some connections.
All right. Oh, great. Yeah, please. We'll send you a book. We'll send it to the president. I'd love it. Okay.
Yeah, I have some channels. But do you want to talk briefly about that?
No, I think I'll finish.
Okay. All right. Is there anything that we've not covered that you would like to cover?
You have done a wonderful job. Perfect.
Okay. Thank you for taking the time to come on. As always, I'm grateful and appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
Have a good evening, and thank you, Amit, for everything you do.
You too. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.